Involvement with the criminal justice system is life-changing. It matters.
Having a justice system that works is a really important part of a democratic society.
I'm Penelope Gibbs, Director of Transform Justice.
I'm Rob Allen. I've worked in and around criminal justice all my career.
This is the Transform Justice podcast, throwing light on the criminal justice system.
Hearing from people who know.
It's about whether the system's fair.
And what can be done to make it better.
Hello. Today we'll discuss one of our age's most wicked problems, domestic abuse. I'm joined by my co-host Rob Allen and by two experts. Jackie Sabir is a retired police officer and one of the authors of Policing Domestic Abuse. Janika Cartwright is a survivor of an attempt on her life by her ex-partner. She's a passionate advocate for restorative justice. This episode contains some detailed descriptions of domestic abuse. Rob, I mean, domestic abuse is one of these terms, but it encompasses an awful lot of stuff. What does it encompass?
Well, instinctively, I think people think about physical and sexual violence in the context of a personal relationship, usually inflicted by a man on a woman, very often a pattern of incidents over time. But it's much broader than that. It obviously includes harassment, stalking, coercive control. It is a huge range of activity. Unfortunately, pretty widespread and a bit of a kind of social crisis, really.
Jackie, it's often said that the police have only recently begun to take domestic abuse seriously, that they used to refer to it as just a domestic. I think you started in the police in the 1990s, is that right?
Yeah, all the way back in 1992, it was referred to as just domestics. No one particularly wanted to go to domestic calls because they weren't interesting or as exciting as an armed robbery or a burglary. And the legislation, I mean, if you think back, it was only in 1990, men were still allowed to rape their wives within marriage. So we have come an awful long way in 30 years. But yes, it was very much a private matter and only really a policing matter when it was really, really serious sort of attempted murders or serious crimes had been committed.
Janika, also looking back, I understand that your grandmother was subject to violence from her own partner. Did you and your family recognise it for what it was, or was it again just seen as something that happens to women and what men did?
My maternal grandmother and my auntie both suffered domestic violence, it was called then, because it was physical violence that they were suffering, and that was very obvious. It was black eyes and, you know, shattered jaws and things like that. And I was very young. So for me, I couldn't understand that as being love. Why would you stay in a relationship like that? What was wrong with my grandmother? What was wrong with my auntie? And then it would be just seeing that everything's just blanketed over and we just have to forget about it. And I still have to go be nice to my uncle, be nice to my step-grandfather. But I knew it wasn't normal. I knew that.
So it wasn't normal, but it wasn't something people in the family kind of took action about?
No, definitely not. And I know police had been involved a couple of times and nothing seemed to happen.
And then you also suffered from domestic abuse. For how long and in what way did your partner abuse you in the years running up to the near fatal attack?
So when I was 28, I got into a relationship with someone I knew as a child. I mean, he was quite aggressive in the beginning and quite angry and did get physical a few times. I ended the relationship after 6 months because he'd pushed me, he'd spat in my face, he'd pulled my hair in an argument and he'd slapped me in the face. So for me, I was like, no way, I'm an independent woman, this is not right, I don't need to be in this. But because I knew his childhood, he'd grown up in a domestic violence household, he'd been molested as a child, I knew I didn't want to be in a relationship with him, but he needed help. So I was kind of still talking to him a little bit via text messages. Then I bumped into him somewhere and he said, you know, I'm getting therapy and I'm so sorry. And, you know, you're the woman of my dreams. And I didn't realise at the beginning of that relationship, actually, that he'd love bombed me. So over the next 6 months, we just started slowly talking and then we entered back into a relationship and he never was violent again. But what took place of that is the jealousy, the paranoia, verbal abuse, mental abuse, emotional abuse. And I never recognised it as abuse because it wasn't physical. Nobody ever educated me on all the rest of the types of abuse. And I also definitely knew that it's not something that I could go to the police about. I just felt he had a nasty mouth when he got angry. And so I just felt at that time that my love could heal him. Sounds really ridiculous now. But, you know, his behaviour had improved. He got a great job. We'd had a child. And it was nice when it was nice and lovely when it was lovely. But it was in hell when it was horrible. And that went on for 5.5 years.
So when you talk about emotional abuse, what was that? Did he insult you? Did he belittle you?
So an example of it could be, I could be driving down the road, staring out the window, kind of a daydream. And all of a sudden, he would be like, who the F are you looking at? Why are you looking at that man? Could you want to have sex with him? And I was like, what man? What are you talking about? He's like, you're a dirty slag. And I would literally be just sitting there, sitting in traffic. And I was like, I don't even know what you're talking about. And I'd be trying to rationalise his thought processes and trying to get to the bottom of, why do you think like that? Like, I've never given you no reason to distrust me. And constantly appeasing him. But it was a lot of quite often that he would do that over the slightest little thing. And I knew that wasn't normal. And I used to say to him, you can't talk to me like that. If you can't handle your emotions, you need to get help with that. But that's not the way you communicate how you're feeling. For him, it was like the insecurity of him not being good enough and thinking that he's going to lose with somebody else. That's why he was horrible, because he's so paranoid.
Mm. I mean, Jackie, we've heard Janika talk about experience over many years. It didn't really involve her at this stage getting the police involved. But is her experience commonplace? Have you heard that kind of story many times before?
It was really interesting because as I was listening to Janika's story, you know, I've gone back in my head of listening to so many different victims of domestic abuse, all telling very similar stories, similar themes. Obviously, everyone's lived experience is different, but the issues, the impact, what actually took place is so, so very familiar to me. And I think for me, there is something all about power, the perpetrator wanting power. And I can remember some perpetrators telling me, especially when they've had repeat victims or had relationships with a number of women, they can pick them out in a room. They will be able to pick out the ones they will be able to victimize. So these themes of taking agency away from you, isolation from your friends, making you feel worthless, the talking down to all the time, it doesn't have to be physical. It really is that sort of coercive and controlling behavior that has such a huge impact over such a long amount of time. But many women don't actually know what's happening to them until it's too late, because it's such a slow creeping effect that it can have over you.
Yeah, I think from what Janika said, the police weren't involved too much at this stage. But what surprises many people is when the police do get involved in these kinds of cases, in I think about half or more of them, the person who has been a victim of abuse doesn't want the police to take any action. Why is that, Jackie?
I mean, this is such a difficult thing. And police are learning and still learning, because many police officers, we return to the same address time and time again and deal with victims who have got black eyes, terrible injuries. You know, we've got spaghetti up the wall and broken furniture everywhere. And, you know, we just got, well, why doesn't she just leave? And this was a very common phrase, and officers often felt frustrated because they would put a lot of time and effort building a case and then the victim didn't want to go to court. And there's a number of reasons why. A, victims are absolutely much more scared of the perpetrator than they are of the police and going to court. But also if they've got children, if the perpetrator is the financial breadwinner for the household. And actually going to court is not an easy process in and of itself. So we have this real dichotomy of, she won't leave, but she needs to leave, or they need to leave to make themselves safe. And Rob, there is no simple answer to this.
I would like to add on to that as well, that is one of the most frustrating questions and the most common questions that is asked. Why don't she just leave? People see it as, you know, the fear and the children, but actually what people I find in my experience miss is love is a reason. And, you know, stigma of a broken home is a reason. I was a single mother. Now I've got another child. I did not want to fail at this a second time round. And I think what people miss is that they're not horrible all the time. And, you know, you hold on to those nice times. And for some, I know it gets worse in pregnancy. For others, it gets better. When I was pregnant, I would say that probably there was one argument we had in that 9 months. And I felt like that was the turnaround. I thought, oh my gosh, this is it now. You know, finally, he's realised I'm not going anywhere and I do love him and he's getting help. And he was having a bit of counselling. You know, promises of reform is another reason as well. And really holding on to that, really wanting it to be a great outcome in the end and believing that if you love them enough, if you appease enough, then they're going to realise that actually you are faithful, you are the person that you're saying you are, and then this is all going to stop, which obviously it's not going to.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right, Janika. And I know we've spoken a lot about female victims, but I've also dealt with male victims of domestic abuse during my career as well. And I can remember there was a male victim of abuse in a hospital ward. He was on sort of life support at one point, battered and bruised. And yeah, it was just dreadful. And, you know, he just said, well, I love her. And officers are really learning and being trained now to try and understand all of these dynamics so we can break that why don't they just leave issue. And I think that's going to take time.
And I completely appreciate how frustrating it is, Jackie, for the police. I was part of setting up a subgroup with the police, actually, in the West Midlands with a superintendent that wanted to kind of raise the voices of the victims. And the one story that stuck out the most and broke my heart the most was a woman who'd been in a relationship for 15 years. She had 4 children and she'd been abusive the whole time, mainly financially abusive and verbally abusive. So when she got to the end and realised, I can't do this anymore, and she wanted to leave, she called the police 3 times. Each time that she called them, she had physically assaulted her. And actually, it had been the same police officers, funny enough, that had come each time. So the 3rd time, he'd beat her so bad that she was lying in a pool of her own blood, nearly unconscious, broke her ribs, broke her jaw, broke her nose. One of the police officers came and said, while she was lying on the floor like that, well, if you just would have left the 1st time, this wouldn't have happened. That's incomprehensible. I can't actually believe that somebody would say that. It's just, where's your human decency? I do get the frustration part because, like, let us help you. But to say that to a victim that's lying there in that situation, know what it takes to leave, and that she's got no family, no support. She knew when she left, she would have nothing. He was a lawyer himself. So he said he'd take everything, leave with nothing. And this is what victims go through all the time.
Janika, that is a really, really sad story. And it kind of leaves me speechless, really, because it was so awful. And in terms of police action, I understand that you yourself were arrested by the police as a result of your ex-partner. What happened there?
So when I'd got to the end of my 5.5-year relationship and I knew that I couldn't do it anymore, I just found out I was pregnant with our 2nd child and I knew I deserved better and there's nothing that I could do to help him. So he called the police and he said that I'd assaulted him. So I'd been arrested, I'd gone to the police station and I said, he's manipulator, he's trying to hurt me because I finished the relationship and I really am done. And she actually said to me, she said, well, at the end of his statement, he'd said, I didn't want to press charges, but considering she no longer wants to be with me, I have no choice but to punish her. And I looked at the police officer, I said, are you absolutely serious? She said, I know, but because when somebody's made a complaint, we have to see it through, but there will be no further action, don't worry. I said, but do you know how much you've just empowered him by bringing me through this process? I couldn't believe it. But I didn't fear him physically because in my mind, I had took control of the situation by setting that boundary at the beginning of the relationship to say, if you ever put a hand on me again, that would be it. And he never did. So in my naivety, I felt like he never would. So we had an argument on the phone and he said, don't you ever think you're going to be in a relationship with somebody else? Because I'd rather kill you before I see you with somebody else. And then what I had to do was get a non-molestation order out on him. So it was ordered that for 1 year, he wouldn't be able to come to my home. He would be able to see the children, but would either have to meet in a public place to swap the children over or at his mother's house. And then when we got the non-molestation order, a mutual friend of ours, she was there and he went back to her house for dinner. And she was phoning me saying, he wants to talk to you. And I said, I'm just done talking. I've got nothing left to say. And then she said, well, he's going to be here for the evening. I'm here. So if you do want to say any last words to him, you're welcome to come over. So I did go I was there for 3 hours talking. He was crying. I was crying. He's apologetic. You know, please give me another chance. I said, I'm done. I wish you well. And I will not stop you from seeing the children because you never harm the children. But I can't do this anymore. This isn't about another man. This is about me taking back my peace. And then I went on holiday the next day.
So again, Jackie, we've heard some more of Janika's story. And obviously her partner was up and down and sometimes trying to be apologetic and ask for another chance. I mean, you've done some research on very serious incidents of domestic abuse. Is that a kind of common feature that the person who abuses, you know, sometimes appears as if everything's fine, that butter wouldn't melt in their mouth, and then a sometimes swing to being, you know, extremely threatening and vindictive?
Absolutely. This is a really common feature of perpetrators, that they are manipulative. They manipulate police officers in interviews. We think, well, how could this fine, upstanding person possibly do this to someone they love? They can be incredibly manipulative at court with their lawyers, and yet at home, they're a completely different person. And sometimes that is through substance misuse, and sometimes that is just through their psychosis. They keep their victims on almost like a tightrope, so they don't know what mood they're in. And victims and survivors become very, very adept at reading moods, and they can adapt their behaviour accordingly. And I think when we talk about risk and risk management, I think it's really important that police officers listen to victims and understand the victim is probably the best person to understand the risk that they're under. And, you know, we have all these tick box forms, but sometimes we don't actually listen to what the victim's saying, that they think their own risk is. And I think that's a factor that policing really needs to think about.
Mm-hmm. So Janika, after you left your partner, he ended up doing very, very serious harm to you. So how did that come about?
So when I came back from the holiday a week later, the moment I landed, my phone started getting abusive texts off him. That was all Sunday. And then it came to the Monday, which was the 1st of July, 2013. So that afternoon, after he'd been calling me and messaging me all morning, I answered the phone. He had £700 that he owed me, and he was using that as his power tool. He said he wasn't going to give it to me. He said, I've got the money I owe you. Can I just see my daughter, please, just for 5 minutes? I've never gone this long without seeing her, which he hadn't. But I said, that's fine, because I do need that money, actually. So I went to meet him. I had our daughter in the car. I was 9 weeks pregnant then with our second child. And I pulled onto the car park. He was already there. I've seen that my daughter's asleep. So I thought, I'm going to have a conversation with him. I took my seatbelt off. He's got into the passenger seat of the car. And as I turned around and looked at him, he had a steak knife in his hand. And his voice was the only way I can describe it, it sounded demonic. His eyes was a different shape and colour. I didn't recognise this person. And he said, if you do not agree to be with me, I'm going to slit your throat right now and go to prison forever for killing you. And backhanded me in the face really hard. And I was so shocked, because I knew in this moment, the person that I knew and the little bit of power I suppose I thought I had gone. So I'm screaming for help. I'm saying, stop, our daughter's in the car, and I love you, and anything I could say. And he was not having it at all. And I'm thinking, I can't flee from this situation because my daughter's strapped into her car seat, but I'm on a gym car park. So I thought, if I just get out of the car and scream for help, somebody would help. So I managed to get out of the car, and I stood up and screamed at the top of my voice, somebody please help me, he's got a knife and he's going to kill me and my baby's here and I'm pregnant. And at the time, there would have been 3 or 4 men on the car park, and they just froze. And in that moment, all my hope just drained out of my body. And I thought, I just had this knowing, no one's going to help me. And by this time now, he's coming round from the passenger side to the driver's side with this knife in his hand, like a crazed maniac. So I'm going to kill you now, and it's all your fault because you don't want to be with me. So I've kind of sat on my seat, lifted my foot up to kick him away, and he went to stab me in my face. All this time I'm thinking, he's doing this to scare me. He's not actually going to go through with this. So I put my arm up in front of my face, and he stabbed me in my arm. And that first stab, I thought, this is happening. I've got no choice now but to fight him. So he proceeded to stab me multiple times, and it felt like it was going on for such a long time. And then somebody shouted, we've called the police, please hold on. So he stopped and he went to his car. And as he drove past me, he looked at me and his face had gone back to normal and he just drove off. There was 23 witnesses standing there in a group. And I knew I'd been stabbed quite a lot of times. I knew that I was in a bad way, but I didn't know how serious it was in that moment. So I looked at my daughter, she was still asleep, which was a miracle that she slept through that. And I collapsed to the floor, still conscious. And I remember I looked up to the sky and said, there's no way my life can end like this, not at the hands of the man that I've loved for 5.5 years. All I've ever wanted to do is to see him be better and to see him heal and to love him better. And the ambulance came. I had to leave my daughter with strangers. The next thing I remember is waking up in intensive care, having had open heart life-saving surgery because he actually stabbed me in my heart. So I was dying on the tarmac that day. And the heart surgeon said in 25 years, he'd never seen anybody come through injuries like this. I shouldn't be alive. It's a miracle that I was alive. That thinking, I've watched my nan and my auntie go through the most disgusting, horrible, abusive, physically violent relationships. And I was locked in this naivety that because it wasn't physical, nothing like this could ever happen to me. But it did. And I just remember saying, a line going over in my head saying, I'm a victor, I'm not a victim. And I knew this was going to change my life dramatically, but I knew I was going to have to fight to overcome what he had done because I wasn't going to let it ruin me, and I'd survived. He tried to take my life and I'd survived that.
That's a dreadful story. Thank you for sharing it with us, and thank God you were able to survive your injuries. It's awful to hear that. Jackie, as a police officer, I mean, you've studied cases of very serious violence and deaths in these kinds of contexts. Again, is this the sort of pattern that happens? I mean, from what Janika was saying, she had no cause really to expect that there would be that level of violence.
Yeah, I'm just as Janika was sharing her experience with us, as I was remembering a particular homicide case I dealt with that's almost a textbook copy of what she had been through. A woman and a mother of three was stabbed to death in her car in London, and sadly she didn't make it. Separation and pregnancy are the key times when the change in that suspect's behaviour can really escalate very, very quickly. The perpetrator is feeling their power crumble, and they have to do something to restore that power because Janika's getting away. She's becoming stronger. She's asserting her authority. And they don't want that. They need you powerless and back in that relationship. So that's when absolutely that high risk period of the inability to predict what that perpetrator is going to do comes. So I think it's such an important element that we have to train officers and all of the agencies and victims themselves to understand. And there is something called a domestic homicide review that takes place. After every domestic homicide that happens, the agencies have to look at the factors and think what could be done to prevent it. And I'm really sad to say I could probably write those homicide reviews before even looking at it, because the same things happen time and time again. Lack of information sharing, lack of communication, short staff, lack of training. There has to be a way of improving all of these common themes that happen time and time again, because whilst they're not predictable, some of them might be preventable.
And it's the case, isn't it, Jackie, that in many of these domestic murders where one partner kills the other, there's been no contact with the police at all.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Penny. In my own personal research, there was very, very few cases where we had been actively involved. So some of the homicides have completely happened out of the blue. Now, there would have been a slow incremental build within that relationship that agencies wouldn't have been aware of. Even the victim themselves might not have been aware of. But the vast majority of domestic violence homicides, the police have had very, very limited engagement with.
And I read that a risk factor is, in fact, the person who in the end commits the murder, a risk factor is that they have attempted suicide.
In many cases, that absolutely is true. There's a lot of evidence, and certainly a lot of cases I've been involved in, where they've killed the wife, the children, because separation was about to happen, or they're having a mental health breakdown, and then they kill themselves. So suicide and attempted suicide, along with separation and pregnancy, is a really important risk factor police and actually health services need to be aware of. So whilst we, of course, given that I'm here, we're focusing a lot on police, but actually there's a lot of training to be done with GPs, with teachers, with people in health professions as well to recognise these signs.
Janika, your ex-partner initially said that he was not guilty. So did you have to give evidence in court?
So like I said, there was over 23 witnesses. Nearly all of them had called the police. So there was no way he was going to get out of this. But to hear that, I thought, not only has he tried to take my life, I nearly actually did succeed in doing so. He's not even going to admit guilt of what he's done. He's not going to take ownership over what he's done. And then it went on for 14 months before it got to trial. Bearing in mind, I've come out of hospital. I've lost my job. I've lost my home. I've lost my car because it happened in my car. So the police kept it as evidence. I was homeless. I was pregnant with my third child. I couldn't walk. I had no fluid around my heart. I couldn't be no further at the bottom of the pit of life of where I was. So 14 months later, we arrive at court and I'm in the toilet outside the court being sick through worry and stress and nerves, thinking it's the first time I'm going to see him. His family are there also as well. So this was very difficult for me. And then my mum ran out and said, it's all over. And I said, well, I haven't even come in yet. So I've been going over my victim impact statement and really wanting to have my voice heard, but also thinking I'm going to have to try and prove to a jury of people that don't know me that I'm telling the truth. And then basically when they'd asked him, do you plead guilty or not guilty? He actually said guilty. And I couldn't believe it. So I didn't get an opportunity to speak, to have my voice heard, to say anything. I just felt like there's no closure in this. There's no justice in it for me. And no one had gave any care to what this had done to me or how this had impacted me or my family.
So in terms of your whole experience of the criminal justice system, I mean, it is supposed to meet the needs of victims, but did it help you heal and move on at all?
Not at all, no. I had to take it into my own hands to fight for my own closure and my own justice.
Sadly, it's just not an isolated story. I think, you know, you've got a lot of hardworking officers there that are really trying to support the victims and trying their very, very best to do the right thing in a system that is broken. And post-COVID, there's an awful lot of delay in the criminal justice system now. Janika should not have waited all of that time. And when you get to court, the facilities aren't nice. The waiting rooms aren't nice. The toilets aren't nice, you know. We don't care for victims in the way that we should do. It is difficult enough to face your abuser. And some victims do find it cathartic to be able to confront and tell their story. And it's absolutely right that people go to court and are actually held to account for what they've done. But the lack of caring for victims going through that really is something fundamentally that needs to be addressed. I've known women and men that have come out of the witness box, and actually it's the best thing that's ever happened to them. For once, they have actually been able to tell their story from beginning to end. Whilst it has been traumatic for them, it's been a powerful experience and they feel empowered because they did that. But others have been re-traumatised by having to tell it again and again and again.
Janika, I know that you couldn't give evidence because you weren't allowed to give evidence. Afterwards, at what point did you think, I want to meet him again. I want to find out more about why he did what he did.
Well, actually, Penelope, for me, it was the day that I woke up in intensive care. There was just no way that I was going to allow this to ruin my life. So the next question was, why? Why has he done this to me? Now, the only person that could ever answer that question was him. And I never heard of restorative justice at that point. But it made sense to me that I wanted to have a conversation with him. So I asked the police officer and he actually said, why on earth would you want to see the person that tried to kill you? Is it because you want to be with him? And I was so taken aback. I was like, no, I just want to ask him why he's done. No, that's never going to happen. The crime's too severe. The risk is too severe. Just forget about it. But I knew what I needed to be able to move forward. And that conversation was what I needed. So for me to be able to then go on a journey for 3.5 years of fighting to get that meeting, and I exhausted every single service that was in the West Midlands, everyone had the same response. And I didn't understand why it was so hard, the fight was so hard. And now when I talk about it, I explain it that the fight for my healing was harder than the fight for my life. Now, how is it that I've become a victim of crime? I'm asking and I'm articulating what I need. And no one is listening. No one is helping. No one is saying, let's explore this.
Jackie, from your point of view, can you kind of see why the police and the other agencies that Janika talked to at this stage in the process might have been so reluctant to encourage this sort of meeting that Janika clearly wanted?
I mean, I share Janika's frustration. We have this very bizarre decision in the UK that domestic abuse crimes do not fall within the category that can have restorative justice. Despite evidence that it actually works, police are not allowed to introduce or speak about restorative justice as an option for victims. There is a project in Hampshire called CARA, which has really good evidence to show at the lower level of domestic abuse, actually it's really successful to stop repeat victimisation. But the trouble is that evidence isn't brought in, that there is no one body that's looking at all of the evidence that restorative justice actually can work or can be an option for some victims in this domestic abuse frame. So I think the reason why we don't do it is fear that actually that the perpetrator will use it as an opportunity to manipulate victims again to get back in touch. But no one's looking at the counter argument and the evidence that we have already to show actually it can work.
Janika, eventually you were able to access restorative justice with the support of a charity called Why Me. Did it work for you?
Absolutely changed my life. They didn't give me no promises or guarantees. They just said, I'm really sorry for your experience so far, and we'll do everything in our power to facilitate this to happen. It is the most powerful tool in a victim's journey of healing if they choose to take part in it. It's a choice, and no one has the right to take that choice away. It was really, really scary to do it, but it was the most empowering thing I've ever done for myself. For those that don't know, you know, when you go into a restorative justice process and meeting, there's two restorative justice facilitators. There was myself and there was him, and there was a prison officer in a room within the prison. They've had to rigorously risk assess for over a year. So you don't just ask for it today and get it tomorrow. All of that's taken place before we get to the meeting. And I was in shock when I saw him face to face and I was sobbing. He couldn't even look at me for at least 10 minutes. We were sat opposite each other. And the first thing I said to him was, why? Why did you do that to me? How could you do that to me after 5.5 years of loving you and having 2 children for you? How could you do that? And he was crying and he just said, I'm sorry, but what I did, it's never going to be enough. And I said, I need to know what happened. I need to know what led up to that day. I need to know where you got the knife from, what was going through your head. And I've got these questions that plagued my mind and kept me awake, suffering from insomnia for 3.5 years, because only he could answer them. And he gave me the answers, which was he'd started taking cocaine, started drinking a lot. He'd give up his job, smoking weed. None of it's justifiable, but at least I had an answer. And he said he didn't go there intending to do that, but he did want to take control back and scare me into being with him because he felt like he'd lost me. So I went through what happened and I could see him cringing. Now, the last time he saw me, he left me to die with our daughter present, covered in blood. And I needed to sit there as a victim of attempted murder is what I was. I needed to sit there as a victor that I was to take my power back. And that's what I did. And it gave me my freedom. I slept the first night I'd ever slept in 3.5 years. I woke up feeling like a new woman and I felt like the weight of him had come off my shoulders. And I had found forgiveness for him. But I want to make clear, restorative justice is not about forgiveness. It's about me taking back my power and releasing myself from the anger and the hatred that was really trying to plague my heart. And I wouldn't be the woman I am today, so free, so at peace, having gained a degree after that, having met the love of my life, married, so happy, if I hadn't had restorative justice that every service tried to block me from having.
Jackie, clearly some people need to be imprisoned to protect their ex-partners and society. But overall, we know that criminal sanctions don't result in either an increase or a decrease in abuse. They don't make a difference. So stepping back and looking at all cases, would you say that we need to perhaps put resources elsewhere than the police?
So throughout my career, the frustrating thing is that the domestic homicide rate has stayed the same. Despite all of the resources, all the new legislation that's been put in, all the time and the effort, the risk assessments, and nothing has changed. It fluctuates at about 100 to 130 domestic homicides a year. Policing has its place. Absolutely, it does. But clearly something is not working because the homicide rate's staying the same. Only about 20% of actual abuse is ever reported. Policing is only one part of it. We've got MARAC, which is a multi-agency response to the most high-risk cases. But actually, not that many cases are high-risk. As we've already mentioned, there's a lot of families that aren't even involved in any agency. We need government and we need society to actually start thinking, how do we stop this? Do we, you know, nothing is working at the moment. So what can we do? What do we know that does work and concentrate and put resources on that? We need some actual focus, like we focused on counterterrorism. How we police counterterrorism should be the way we police domestic abuse. It's a threat to our society. So actually we need that joined up, consistent, resourced approach to think what works and actually follow something through. And we don't know what works with perpetrators. How can we protect victims best? We still don't know. We know restorative justice does work in some cases. It gives agency and choice back to survivors where all of their choices were taken away. So I think there actually has to be, for once, a really concerted effort around what do we want as a society and how are we going to make that work? We'll never stop it, but how can we prevent it?
Okay, perhaps that's a note on which we should draw this incredible discussion to an end. It's been very moving and difficult to take part in a way, but I've certainly learned a lot, and I'm sure our listeners will. What we'd like to do to finish is to ask each of you, if you were in charge of policy in this area, if there was one change that you would introduce to try and improve the response to domestic abuse, what would that be? Jackie, can I start with you?
I would police domestic abuse like we police counterterrorism in terms of the resources, the focus, the skills and the leadership that are given to that. That is what I would do in terms of the policing response to domestic abuse.
Janika?
All I think about is having the victim as the focus and really listening and learning from what's gone over many, 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 many years. We're all allowed to have opinions about things, and people say they're not judgmental, but people are judgmental. But I think when you're in a position of authority, in a position of power, you're a police officer, you're a government, you know, those things can't come into play. It's what can we do to make this better, to reduce this? Because unfortunately, I don't believe we're ever going to eradicate domestic abuse. That hurts me to say. I've got children. I know it doesn't just happen to women. I've got a best friend whose brother was murdered by his girlfriend and all the things, different things she's had to go through. It ruins lives. And for me, I focus on the healing journey because no one's looking at that. My ex-partner was locked up, but he's going to be let out one day. I'm still trying to overcome the fear that's going to come from when he comes out and not being supported in that. So I think definitely having the victim as the focus and listening and being victim-led in what you're doing, it's a serious crime, and it doesn't make the victim of this crime less of a person, weak, feeble, because they've become a victim of domestic abuse, because it can happen to anyone.
Thanks. Rob, what would you do to reduce domestic abuse?
Well, I'm usually not stuck for ideas, but this is such a big one. I started by saying that this is a sort of social crisis. So I think the answers lie a lot outside criminal justice. Yes, the criminal justice system needs to get its house in order in dealing with these kinds of cases. I'd like to see a big program of research to really try and help us understand why we have this problem, why men primarily are doing this, what schools, social services, health can do to really try and prevent this happening in the first place. And when it does happen, those agencies can be brought in to try and intervene alongside criminal justice.
Thanks, Rob, Janika and Jackie. And if you'd like more information about Jackie's book or about the role of restorative justice in addressing domestic abuse, do look at our programme notes. And if you recommend the podcast, do rate it highly, please. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.
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 Goodbye.